Once again, let me express my appreciation for the opportunity to be here with you, and particularly for those of you who've come out on Sunday evening to continue this study. Let's work through the rest of this outline. Won't go any longer than we set aside, and depending on the pace, might be shorter. But we're talking about the tongue. Number 9 on your outline, the power and the impotence of words in Proverbs. We left it before we address never substitute for actions, 14:23. Another aphorism, a short, pithy statement, another antithetical proverb. One thing and then something opposite. Remember this morning we said there's 6 kinds. One of the kinds is it states something and then it states its opposite. All hard work brings a profit, but mere talk leads only to poverty. Now that's something that you might read in Ben Franklin or the Farmer's Almanac. All truth didn't have to fall off Mount Sinai. There's some things that are just so true, they're obvious. But then sometimes we need a statement of the obvious just to keep us reminded. And I see some proverbs like that. You read that and say, that's obvious. I could have thought of that. Talk is cheap, we say sometimes. But we need to be reminded of the obvious. St. Augustine, the great North African Christian, Augustine of Hippo Regis, said, repetition is the essence of learning. It's true. Piano student practices scales over and over and over, and then after a while that student is able to sight read music. It started repeating the simple. Now, the value of reticence. This is a famous proverb. Even fools are thought to be wise if they keep silent, and discerning if they hold their tongues. Now that's synonymous parallelism. It says the same thing two ways. We're talking about types of proverbs. This is a restatement. Fools are thought wise if they keep silent, and discerning if they hold their tongues. And I've heard it said, you know, if you keep your mouth shut, people may think you're wise. If you open it, they may find out you're not. And so, you know, there's wisdom in silence. Any of you remember a movie, I guess, probably better part of 30 years ago, Peter Sellers, the British actor, was in it. It was called Being There, and he played a person, Chauncey Gardner. It's a spoof, it's a comedy. Chauncey Gardner was some very limited, simple man who'd been locked up inside an estate as the gardener. When the estate owner died, they turned him out, and he really had never been in the outer world. And by a series of the most unlikely connections, he came to the attention of the U.S. government. He had no transcripts, no background, no records. And the movie is a spoof on the fact that since Chauncey said practically nothing at all, they thought he was brilliant. Winds up a huge spoof. The President of the United States is in trouble. They consider him to be the wisest of all people. They ask him, I need to say something to the nation. And since he'd been a gardener, Chauncey Gardner said, tell them, if you plant it, it will grow. It's the only thing he ever said in the movie. President gets on TV and tells the nation, if you plant it, it will grow. And everybody thinks it's the wisest thing they ever heard. And the plot of the movie was this man who never said anything was thought to be enormously wise. Well, even though that's a spoon, there's some truth for that. I'm on a faculty of 20 PhDs. And just to say that's to say, you know, you got a challenge right there. And I've noticed this among my colleagues. Those who say the least are the most heard when they say something. It's an interesting observation, and I've seen it. I've watched it at work on 15 years on a faculty. Those who are reticent get heard best of all. Now, the next thing we come to is really, in many ways, the strangest chapter in Proverbs. I called it numerical sayings, and referred earlier to the fact that chapter 30 are the words of a wise person named Agur, A-G-U-R. We don't know who he is. They were declared to Ithiel and Ukal. No, we have no idea who any of those people were, but they're numerical sayings. They follow a device. And if you read it beginning in 7, two things I request of you. And then if you go over to verse 15, the leech has two daughters, give and give. There are three things that are never satisfied, four never say enough. Or verse 18, three things which are too wonderful for me, four which I do not understand. And the rest of the chapter follows that formula of numerical statements, three, yea, four. And the suggestion is this was a mnemonic device. It was a way of teaching, a way to help people's memory, to state things this way, a device for teaching. Now, these are by and large nature sayings. It's saying if you look at nature, you'll find out something about grace and the way God does things. Anybody here, I'm sure somebody would have a copy of The Message, Eugene Peterson's translation. Familiar with that? The Message. More millions of copies. I ate with Gene one time. It always fascinated me. How did you do that? And Gene said, I found out that everything in nature illustrates something in grace. And that was his principle in translating The Message. And if you keep that in mind, you see that. He uses natural things to explain things in grace. It's just like 2 Corinthians 4:17. The King James says, this light momentary tribulation worketh out an eternal weight of glory. Gene translated that, your troubles now are small potatoes compared to the glory to come. Now, if you're from my neck of the woods, you know what small potatoes means. It's not worth messing with, not worth bothering with. That's how he thought. Well, this is similar. It takes some spiritual truths and compares them to things in the natural world. So let's take a moment and look at these. They're different from any of the other Proverbs. First of all, four insatiable things. The leech, you know what that is, has two daughters. Give, give, they cry. He points to that which sucks life-sustaining stuff out. They give, give. Now here's the three and four. There are three things that are never satisfied. Four that never say enough. That is, they never stop saying, give me. The grave, the barren womb, land, which is never satisfied with water, and fire, which never says enough. If I were to give another heading to this, I would say four inevitabilities in life. Life does have some inevitabilities. Ecclesiastes says the same thing in chapter 11. Life, human life in this world does have boundaries. And here he's setting before you four inevitabilities. They will always be hungry. You know, our first parents were set in a perfect place. Bible believer, I think Sunday night church at a Bible study is a group of Bible believers for sure, set in a perfect place. And they had everything. Adam even got to name everything. Remember that? I don't know, dog came by and he said, let's call that dog. Said, he probably said it in Hebrew. Son. Got the name of everything. God said, all of this is yours except what? One thing. Just to show that I'm God and you're not, life has one boundary, that tree. They had everything except that. And they couldn't stand the fact that there was a boundary. Story of all of us, isn't it? That's why it rings true, the goodness of God in our life. And he says right here, no. And when he says no, we're like a child. Ever put a bud vase on the coffee table and tell a two-year-old, don't touch that vase? What happens to that vase? That becomes the most interesting object in the house, doesn't it? They must know something about touching bud vases, and boom, there goes the bud vase. Life without boundaries. Well, here Proverbs is trying to say there are some inevitabilities in life. And they call us up short to face them. Three things and four. First of all, the grave. This personifies the Hebrew word Sheol. Sheol was a synonym for the grave. It was that world of shades where the Hebrews said you went right after dying. It personifies it and says the grave never says enough. One of the inevitabilities of life, and for us, barring the shout of the archangel and the trump of God, which I believe with all my soul will happen, but barring that, we're going to go there. William Saroyan, the short story writer, said, I know everybody would die, but I thought an exception would be made in my case. I like what Tony Campolo, you ever, Tony Campolo, American Baptist social commentary. Tony will say just about anything. He's saying, unless the Lord come back, you're going to die. They're going to put you in a box. They're going to put that box in a box, put you in the ground, go back to the church, eat potato salad, and talk about you. He kind of nailed it right there. He says the grave is not satisfied. I was thinking the other day, you know, at the end of the year, you get to be my age, you know how they have a list of everybody who went on that year? If you get to be a certain age, they get to be more and more your generation when they give that list. At the end of the year, it gets to be more like you, says the grave. The barren womb, we would say today that's a genderless thing. Think of Rachel or Hannah over in 1 Samuel. They're crying out at the shrine of Shiloh. Or land, which is never satisfied with water. Now remember, the setting of this is in the ancient Near East, where a big rain came every 50 years. When that big rain came, it was as if the water would go all the way through earth to China, soaked it up. You imagine a huge rain every 50 years. The barren land in the Judean wilderness just swallowed it whole. And then fire, a raging wildfire that consumes everything. In a sense, he's saying, brace yourself, face life. It has some inevitabilities. We take a verse like Philippians 4:13. I can what? Do all things through Christ who strengthens me. Well, let's sit there just a minute. Is that a promise that I can do everything? I remember some years ago going to Cowboys game, my sons and I started with Thanksgiving afternoon. This particular game, I remember it, when kind of shanked a field goal, they lost the game. I remember thinking, you know, man, they need some help. And I just went crazy. I started to think, you know, I wonder if they could make a reality show, make Gregory a cowboy. Get the best trainers, dietitians, hit the weights. No, that's not going to happen. Life has some boundaries. Now, I could quote Philippians 4:13 all I want to. I'm not going to be a cowboy. It's a failure to see that human life has some boundedness. When Paul said that, I can do all things through Christ which strengthens me, he's in jail in Rome waiting for a verdict on his life. And what he means in the context is whether Nero says, I live or I die, I can face it. It didn't mean I can go out and do a 40-foot pole vault. Y'all with me? Human life has boundaries. And let me tell you one of the most important things I have found out. God is God and I'm not. Did y'all ever hear the story of the neurotic rooster? Can't remember if I told you this story or not. The neurotic rooster's in the barnyard every morning. The sun came up and the rooster would crow, wake up the hens, the swine, the sheep, the cattle, even the farmer got up. And crow, everybody woke up. And then the rooster made a foul deduction. That's funny, I'll think about that. Made a foul deduction, decided not that he crowed because the sun came up, but the sun came up because he crowed. Well, first of all, he got insomnia. Couldn't sleep because he thought he wouldn't wake up and the world wouldn't start. Finally, they had to haul him off to home for disturbed roosters. Because he thought the world depended on him. One thing life teaches you about its inevitabilities is that you don't have to solve everything. And this proverb, I think, is best understood as faith, life's inevitabilities. But then in the wonderful balance of Proverbs, you say, well, wouldn't that make you cynical? No, because look at the next thing. Four things that excite wonder. Even though you face life's inevitabilities, there are things that bring about a sense of wonder. Childish joy. There are three things that are too amazing to me, four that I do not understand. The way, look at this, of the eagle, here's nature, eagle in the sky, a snake on a rock, a ship on the high seas, and the way of a man with a young woman. Here's someone who remains the capacity to look with open mouth wonder at the world. Now look at these things. First of all, the eagle. The eagle to the Hebrews was a great wonder. That's why over in that beautiful ending of Isaiah 40, 28 and following, talks about they'll mount up with wings as what? Eagles. Because Hebrew shepherds out there watching the sheep in the Judean wilderness, they didn't have smartphones, they didn't have TV, they hadn't anything. All they did was look. Day and night, look. And at the end of the fall, the eagle, they'd say, that old bird's had it. That bird been there, that bird doesn't look good. But then in the spring, the eagle would have molted, it would have new feathers, it would fly off out of a crag, and they'd say, there it is again, mounting up with wings. And they had a sense of wonder about it. Now, snake. The ancient world, a snake was more than just a snake. They say there are 30 varieties of snakes in the Holy Land, and since it's mostly raw, the Hebrew would wonder, how can this thing move with no feet? And it excited a sense of wonder. And then look at a fourth thing here. The way of a ship through the sea. Now understand, the Hebrews were landlubbers. The Hebrews said, Sheol, hell has four mouths. One's in the desert, one's in Jerusalem, and one's in the sea. If you read Psalm 107, it makes it clear the Hebrews thought the sea was always about to swallow up the dry land unless God held it back like a boundary. The sea was a threat. Now, Phoenicians were sailors. Isn't it funny? Right by them, but the Hebrews were landlubbers. That's why Jonah was so daring when he got in that boat. You know, if you look at Paul's journeys, you know, in the back, the maps in the back of your Bible, you'll see they looped in and out of coves along the coast of Turkey. They didn't like the open water. So to the Hebrew, a ship sailing through the sea, excited a sense of wonder. And then last of all, talking about romantic love, the way of a man with a young woman. Remember that in the synagogue and in society as a whole, there was a stern segregation of the sexes. Men sat in the synagogue. I'd say this, ladies, there's a place in the back for the men, but it was, life was like that. There was a group of rabbis who were so radical about that that they were called the bruised ones. True story. They took Job seriously, cover their eyes lest they look upon a maid, and they walked around looking down and they ran into stuff, so they were called the bruised ones. It's a very strict kind of separation. True story. But then suddenly, young man meets a young woman, and the mystery of love and attraction and connection took place. I said, isn't that a wonder how that happens over and over? Here's a group of people who didn't lose a sense of wonder. I was 17 years old, freshman at Baylor. Left in the middle of my high school year, some big hurry to get, I don't know why, I can't know, Mike, I was in such a big hurry to get down there for some reason. Sitting in Old Testament class, a wonderful teacher, Professor Dr. Kyle M. Yates, warned us. He said, young people, avoid cynicism at all cost. I'd never heard the word, but I love the old man so much I wrote it down. And I went back, I remember 306 Coconut Hall, and looked up the word cynicism. I remember that day. This jaded sense, seen everything, done everything, nothing excites wonder in me. I doubt it. The Greeks had a name for it. It was considered a vice in the ancient church. Akadia, asadia. It means I'm satiated, nothing moves me anymore. That's not a biblical virtue. This passage says there ought to be that about us which is still astounded with a sense of wonder. I try to practice that. Keep away from, I've seen everything, done everything. One reason I like Theodore Roosevelt. Theodore Roosevelt, president from 1901 to 1908. Lived to be 60 years old, died January 1990, and if he lived, he'd probably been elected again. Theodore never lost a sense of wonder. In fact, when he was president, the French ambassador, a man named Cecil Spring Rice, had to write back and say, you've got to understand, Theodore is about 6 years old. And he's talking about him as president. He liked to go to Rock Creek Park. He'd lead the whole cabinet out on hikes on icy days. They thought he was crazy. He'd get up in the attic of the White House and play hide and seek with his six kids. One time in the dark, he was president. He hit his head on one of the rafters and knocked himself out. He loved nature. Set aside more birdland. In fact, when he was a little boy, he liked to collect birds in New York City where his dad was a rich guy, and he'd stuff them. But the last picture ever taken of him, the last picture in January 1919, he was out at one of the bird sanctuaries that he had set aside, surrounded by thousands of egrets. Always had a sense of wonder. Read about a life like that. His eye was not sated. I love that statement. Remember, Theodore's about 6 years old. He didn't lose a sense of wonder. And that's what this is appealing to. Still a sense of, this is exciting. It's a sad thing to see people that are sated. Well, okay, next thing, four things. We're in chapter 30. Have you ever taken one of those tests and it had four things and it said, which one of these doesn't belong? It used to be on the GRE, the graduate record exam. Which one of these does not belong? Well, here it says, here's Here's things that don't fit. Under three things the earth trembles, and under four it cannot bear up. Now that's ironic. It doesn't. He's using metaphorical language. He said these things are so bad they make the earth shake. Topsy-turvy. A servant who becomes king. That is moving from the lowest place to the highest place. Boom. A godless fool who gets plenty to eat. That gives it the name of the novel, Feast of Fools. A contemptible woman, a woman held in contempt, who gets married, and a servant who displaces her mistress. Think of the story there of Hagar and Sarah. You know, when you read that story, you need to read the rest of the story. You know, Abraham needs a baby. You know, that great story. First of all, he thinks it's going to be Eliezer, his manservant, who will inherit the prophet. And God says, no, it's going to be a child of your own loins. So Sarah hatches a scheme to give him Hagar, her young lady servant. And there's Ishmael. The rest of the story is Hagar comes to hold Sarah in contempt, and Ishmael holds Isaac, and it's a mess. That whole story, really, the children of Israel, turns out to be one generation of another after a mess because of contempt. Same thing happens in the next generation. Jacob, you know, wants to marry Rachel, worked 7 years. Goes on the honeymoon, lights come on the next morning, he has Leah, 7 more years, gets Rachel. Leah has babies, Rachel doesn't. And if that were not bad enough, you read the story, both of them give Jacob their handmaids as concubines, Bilhah and Zilpah. The children of Israel are 12 kids with 4 mothers in one tent. You don't have to be James Dobson to recognize that probably didn't work out. I mean, give me a break. Rachel, Leah, Bilhah, Zilpah, the children of Israel were born out of all kinds of contempt. Just think about it. You can read about it in the book of Genesis. Now, that's what he's saying. Here are some things that disrupt. That upside down, sudden promotion from being the lowest to the highest. Like, say, going from the mailroom to the corner office of the CEO. A godless fool, too much to eat. Someone held in contempt, getting married, servant, servant. This is just kind of common sense. Let me tell you what these do. C.H. Dodd, the great New Testament scholar, said a parable, and these are really parabolic. A parable is a story the meaning of which is sufficiently in doubt to tease the mind into active thought. Now, let me say that again. A parable is a story the meaning of which is sufficiently in doubt to tease your mind into active thought. And that's how these statements are. They tease your mind into thinking about this. That's the intention. Now let's look again. Here's another one. The mouse that roared, I call it. Started to call this animal crackers. Do they still make animal crackers? Huh? They do, yeah. Okay, good. Started to call it animal crackers. Well, 4 things are small, yet they're extremely wise. Here he looks at the world of nature a different way. Ants, little strength, they store up their food in the summer. Badgers, this word hyraxis probably means a badger. Creatures of little power, yet they make their home in the crags and they survive. Locusts, they don't have a king, but they march. You saw a picture just the other day of a locust plague in Egypt that looked biblical. The armies of them. And then a lizard. Now this Hebrew word may mean lizard, it may mean spider. Can be caught with its hand, yet it's found in kings' palaces. You can just imagine it. Here's a palace, guarded, moats, guards, army. But here's a gecko. And with all the guards, you can't keep the gecko out of the king's bedroom. Now, once again, this is prayer book. It's a sense of exciting one. How the smallest may be the wisest. Look at the ant. The weakest may have accessibility where guards can keep other people out. It's in a sense how God does the strangest of things with things that look so small, and yet they can mean so much. He only lived to be 42 years old. I looked his grave up when I was in Cairo. He's buried in a British military cemetery that's been kept since World War I. It's fenced up, kept by the British, green grass in the desert, little white military tombstones for British soldiers. He was an art student at the University of Edinburgh, but came to Christ and became a minister, started a little Bible college, struggled with it some. But in World War I, when the troops were sent to Cairo to train in order to go to the Crimea and face almost certain death, he volunteered as a YMCA chaplain. And in a little hut, you can look it up, literally a little hut, he'd meet with these British soldiers, teenagers, before they'd go off to the Crimean War. His bride, Gertrude, had a gift for shorthand. She could take it down at 150 words a minute. And while he gave his Bible studies, she wrote down in shorthand. He contracted appendicitis and died. He didn't have to die, but he refused to take the bed of a soldier. And he died. Really preventable, you might say. They buried him with full military honors. His widow, young woman, was left with a baby, went back to Oxford, opened up a boarding house just to keep body and soul together. But when the boarders left, she went down to the basement and on a typewriter took those shorthand notes made in a hut in the desert and broke them up into 365 daily readings in a book that probably, next to the Bible, may have been the most read book of daily devotionals for 100 years. His name was Oswald Chambers. And the book is My Utmost for His Highest. I remember going to that grave. I grew up with Oswald. I read him day by day. So many years. I've made notes on the days, what was happening in my life. Sent my adult sons away. I just sat there in front of that little white tombstone in the desert, legs crossed, and just looked at it. And thanked God that in that little hut, with a handful of British soldiers, Gertrude took those words down. Sliced them up into 365 days and blessed the whole world. Ruth Bell Graham, Mrs. Billy Graham, said no book in her whole life influenced her more than My Utmost for His Eyes. Sometimes God can take the smallest things and bring about the largest blessings. He said, look at the ant. Look at the badger. Look at the gecko. Who can take hold and be in the king's room. Little things that make a big difference. Now, he moves to something very different. The inevitability of hubris. Now, hubris is the Greek word for overweening pride. Pride that cannot be controlled. It's pride on steroids. It's not your everyday five and dime store pride. It's overweening pride. Basically, he says, don't chafe. Just get over it when you see it in other people's lives. There are three things that are stately in their stride, four that move with stately bearing. A lion, mighty among the beasts, who retreats before nothing, a strutting rooster, a he-goat, and a king secure against revolt. It's almost their Hebrews here, like the old Beatles song, just let it be. Some people chafe when they see pride in other people. Eats them up. He's saying here, look, just the way it is. A lion, a strutting rooster, he-goat, and a king who's so secure. Just let God deal with it. Look at that last one, the king who's secure. Do you remember the story of Nebuchadnezzar in the book of Daniel? Great story. Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, he's strutting along up on top of his palace wall. And remember what he says to himself? See this great Babylon that I built? It was great. In fact, they've dug up the bricks from ancient Babylon. Here in Texas, it may say Acme on the brick. Every brick in Babylon had the name Nebuchadnezzar on it. As far as I could see, his name was stamped into the bricks. Look at this great. And you remember what God did? Took him from the palace to the pasture. He started to suffer from a known, it's even today, a known psychological illness called boanthropy. Lycanthropy is thinking you're an animal. Avianthropy is thinking you're a bird. Boanthropy is thinking you're an ox. And they shut him up in a royal game preserve until he came to himself. But that didn't bug Daniel. You see Daniel quitting? He's still opening his window to the east, praying toward Jerusalem. That's basically what Proverbs say. You're going to run into arrogant people. And if you don't know that, let me tell you, you are going to run into arrogant people. So proud they could strut sitting down. He just says, don't chafe about it. God has a way of dealing with that. That's very true. I've run, didn't want to be one, but God, I hope I haven't, but I've run into plenty of them. And sometimes it can make you chafe. He said, don't let that happen. It's good advice, really. Now, finally, the ideal companion. Now, this is Proverbs 31. This is the word of King Lemuel's mother. Here's another word of wisdom from somebody other than Solomon, the word of King Lemuel's utterance, which his mother told him. What, my son, son of my womb, and so forth. And it talks about in verse 10, who can find a virtuous wife, and so forth. I just want to make one observation about this. This does not describe the average day in the life of a good woman. If it did, I don't think you'd get past the day. Talks about her worth, husband trusts her. She seeks wool and flax, you read all it. Like the merchant ship, brings her food before, rises while it's night, cooks food, then goes out, sells real estate, considers the field, buys it, and so forth. Sometimes I've heard this treated as if this is the regular day in the life of an average lady. No, this is a composite picture, and it speaks of that world. It speaks of the world then. If you were to reduce this to principles, I'd say the principles that are stated here are principles of trust, industry, not idleness, provision, foresight, and a variety of interests. Now, these were written for a world 3,000 years ago. And what was the responsibility in that kind of world of a matriarch? If you transplant this today, it's talking about principles of life. Trust. Trust is gone, everything's gone. Industry. Provision, foresight, variety of interest. And that's what I'm going to say about that. Not parse every word of it. But I do want to come to make a few concluding remarks about this study. It's about time to go. I want to remind you once again that these are proverbs and not promises. Now, I know that may grate on some ears, but it's the nature of these to say, here's the way life under God is, and here's the way it usually works out. I want to also leave you with the reminder in 1 Corinthians 1:30, the apostle writing the Greeks who loved wisdom, the very word philosophy is love of wisdom, sophos, wisdom. The Greeks loved wisdom. They worshiped at the shrine of Socrates, Plato, Aristotle. Paul wrote them in that proud Corinthian church and said, Christ is made to you wisdom. In that sense, everything the book of Proverbs is writing about flows through us in fellowship with Him. I was talking to a friend over here earlier. There's an organic quality about it. It's not that a Christian clenches fist and grits teeth and says, I gotta be wise. Even more than a peach tree says, peaches. It just grows. Peaches. And this book is not a book that's calling for strain. It's calling for discipline, but not strain. The only way I know how to live out Proverbs, and I think I've walked with the Lord long enough to get a sense of this, is that when I'm walking with Him with an ungrieved, unquenched spirit, unclouded sky, everything confessed and walking in the sunlight with Him, walking in light, life just tends to work out that I live more like this. It's like this. You ever go to Kansas and see a field full of sunflowers? What happens to the head of the sunflower as the sun goes across the sky? Anybody know? Huh? Now, does that sunflower say, turn? No. It just follows the sun. Every 12 hours and 25 minutes about that, there's low tide and there's high tide. You think the ocean says, it's got to be high tide. No. It's just the invisible gravitational effect of the moon. No physicist, no cosmologist can exactly explain that, but it does it. Here's a salmon. Salmon leaves this little rivulet, goes down a tributary to a creek, you know, to a stream, to a river, goes out in the Atlantic, go out as far as Iceland and Greenland and eat for 3 years. And then, like somebody flipped a switch, stops eating, comes back and finds just that river it came from. Nobody's been able to explain that. Is it some magnet thing in their head? Is it chemical? Goes up that river to a tributary, to a creek, finds its way back. Yeah. So good. And I want to say in leaving, when we're walking with Christ, when even though unseen, He's more real than any other, then the kind of life describes here, in my life, I can give a testimony. A person with a testimony is never at the mercy of somebody with an argument. It's a good thing about testimony. They can argue with apologetics. They can't argue with the testimony. My testimony is, when I walk like that, a lot of what I read here just flows. So the end of this is where the end of everything in Hebrew Scripture is. It points not towards something, but to a coming somebody. The author of Proverbs, the authors only looked back to Mount Sinai and smoke and fire and Ten Commandments and a tabernacle and millions of animals that had been sacrificed. Thank God we don't look there. We look back to Mount Calvary, the opening of the veins and the shedding of the blood of the Son of God, and an open, empty tomb, and the promise that he gave and kept. If I go away, I'm going to send you another paraclete, another helper. And he kept his promise. That's how we can embody these wise sayings.